Carolinas are being swamped by these heavy rains and high winds from Hurricane Florence.
The best scientists in the world are all telling us that our activities are changing the climate.
I don't think it's a hoax. I think there's probably a difference, but I don't know that it's man-made.
Experts say that we have until 2030 to avoid catastrophe.
Hello again, I'm Aaron Almy, and this is the Climate Change Update on To The Point. President Trump has not just denied the threat of climate change, he's used his authority to increase the growth and development of fossil fuels. His appointees to various agencies have revoked or amended federal regulations designed to promote alternative energy and reduce greenhouse gases. And worldwide, the lack of progress to slow global warming has produced a new generation of scathing critics. 16-year-old Greta Thunberg of Sweden is one of their voices.
You are not mature enough to tell it like it is. Even that burden you leave to us children. But I don't care about being popular. I care about climate justice and a living planet.
Back to this country, the so-called Green New Deal proposed by progressive Democrats in Congress is designed to define the problem and suggest solutions. But President Trump has ridiculed it as a threat to the industrial economy and even to life as we know it.
And when I look at what's happening on the other side, I encourage it. I say, no, I think the New Green Deal, or whatever the hell they call it. No planes. No energy. When the wind stops blowing, that's the end of your electric.
So the U.S. is falling behind other countries in just beginning to deal with what climate scientists call an existential crisis. Does that have to be all she wrote? Michael Gerard says no. He is director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University, and he's author of a new book, I should say co-author, and that's important. The book's titled Legal Pathways to Deep Decarbonization in the United States. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, what's deep decarbonization?
The basic idea was set forth in a technical report that was issued about 4 years ago of how we can reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions 80% by the year 2050. And so it has a whole host of strategies for how to do that.
Okay, strategies involving what authorities and what people?
So this would be action at the federal level, the state level, the local level, and by private enterprise. There are three basic pillars. The first is energy efficiency. The second is moving away from fossil fuels for our electricity supply. And the third is moving away from liquid fuels for our automobiles and home heating and so forth to clean electricity. And so a combination of actions at every level of government can help achieve that.
Tell us about your book and how important it is that there is a coalition of people behind you.
My co-editor, John Dernbach, who's a professor at Widener University in Pennsylvania, and I put together a team of about 60 experts from around the country, mostly law professors and lawyers with non-governmental organizations and private practice, to put together this book, which is about 1,100 pages, 35 chapters, goes into enormous detail on the legal nitty-gritty of the whole host of things that can be done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the United States.
Well, now you say federal, state, local, and private strategies are involved here. How do you overcome the president and the fact that Congress can't do much as long as he's in office?
We recognize that at the federal level, not a lot good is going to happen until after the next election, and hopefully things will change then. We want to be ready once that happens. But meanwhile, there are many states and cities that are now eager to act on climate change. There's a lot that they can do through every sector, both in and of themselves and to be examples for each other and what the federal government can do. So right today, there are multiple actions that can be taken.
California, of course, has done a lot, but it's often said that all that does is reduce carbon emissions in California, which is a small portion, unfortunately, of the total amount. So how does this help?
Well, if California were a country, they would be about the seventh largest economy in the world. And there are a total of 23 states that have signaled that they want to take action with almost half of the U.S. economy. And so it really adds up to a substantial amount when they take the action that is within their power and may well be within their political will.
But the Trump administration already is challenging California and trying to shut down what Governor Jerry Brown left behind.
Yeah, only one aspect of it with respect to motor vehicle emissions. And it's not at all clear he will be successful in doing that. But all the other things that California is doing are completely beyond the reach of President Trump and are going to continue just as the actions by all the other states are going to continue regardless of what he tries.
Well, let's go away from California. What about some of these other states, and particularly those who haven't been able to do much so far? What makes you think they're going to have the political will, you referred to that earlier, to do anything now?
Well, there are now 23 states that have Democratic governors. Almost as many states have Democratic control of both houses of their state legislature. The recent polling has shown that most Democrats are very strongly in favor of acting on climate change, and a whole lot of Republicans are as well. I'm seeing in my own state of New York that the legislature in Albany and Governor Andrew Cuomo seem to be on the verge of passing very strong climate legislation. We're seeing a lot of action in multiple other states.
So what do local agencies do, let's say, in the industrial heartland? Suppose a mayor wants to do something about climate change. What's available there?
Well, in the first place, one of the most important actions on climate change is improving energy efficiency, and a great deal of the energy is used in buildings. The energy efficiency of buildings is very largely under local control. So is land use. So zoning actions, transportation actions, energy efficiency in buildings, the kinds of heating and cooling systems that are used in buildings, all of these are very much subject to municipal control.
You mentioned electricity as the second thing you're focusing on after efficiency. That's pretty big for local authorities.
Well, there are quite a few public power authorities and municipal agencies. In addition, the cities decide where to buy their electricity. In many states, they have the option of buying electricity from selected providers, and they can select renewable energy resources. Quite a bit of electricity is generated within cities, and cities have local authority over the kinds of fuels that are used. So there's a good deal of flexibility here. Additionally, cities are in the forefront of encouraging solar on rooftops, fuel cells, lots of energy efficiency and local generation methods.
And do those things work even where the climate doesn't allow the sun to be out very much?
So you have different places that have different power sources. Some are better for sun, some are better for wind, some have geothermal resources, some have hydro resources. So depending on your geography, you can see what is the best renewable resource for that area.
What do state and local authorities have to do about transportation?
In the first place, it's state and local governments that are in charge of the road system and in charge of the land use density and whether transit is feasible. They are in charge of how much space is devoted to cars as opposed to bicycles and pedestrians. In almost every way, it's really the states and the cities that are responsible for transportation. New York City is about to have congestion pricing, modeled after London, the first place in the country to have that. That's entirely a state and local decision. The federal government has nothing to do with it.
Okay, so let's get back to your book. It's a kind of handbook. You don't have to read the whole thing if you are somebody at the local level, for example, who wants to find out what can be done. Tell us a bit more about the book itself and how it is designed to work.
So we have an index at the back by actor. And so if you're in a local government, you can see what are the actions that a local government can take. You can see what are the actions that a state public utility commission can take. You can see what actions different federal agencies can take. So depending on where you are situated, you can see what actions might be relevant. And so for each of the 35 chapters, we go through all the legal details on who is authorized to do what, and then we get into the recommendations, more than 1,000 specific recommendations that can be undertaken. There's no magic bullet. There's no one thing that'll do it. We require action on at least hundreds of these recommendations, and that's what we're trying to encourage.
To what extent are you mobilizing with other attorneys around the country?
So what we've done is a fellow named Richard Horsch, who just retired as an environmental partner at a big law firm in New York City, is taking this on, and we are signing up law firms and lawyers around the country to take on the task of doing the legal work that's necessary to carry out these recommendations. It requires a lot of drafting of model local ordinances, state laws, state regulations, model federal statutes and regulations that we hope can come in the next presidential administration, model transactional agreements. So all of us are doing this for free on a pro bono basis. None of us are being paid anything, but we're getting a lot of volunteer interest from lawyers around the country to pitch in and do this legal work that is necessary to carry out the more than 1,000 recommendations we have.
You say by 2050, you think you can reduce emissions by 80%. How can you do it that fast?
The technologies are developing rapidly. The economics are getting much better. The cost of wind and solar and storage have all plummeted so that they are now competitive with and in many ways much more economical than traditional fossil resources. We're seeing a large number of entrepreneurs who see the economic possibilities here to build out the wind and solar and everything else we need. And part of what this book is aimed at is clearing away some of the legal obstacles. There's a lot of red tape that can be cut or shortened, lots of other activities that will expedite the process.
But what you're suggesting is that at the local level, with a grassroots kind of movement, you can pressure local officials to do the kinds of things that you recommend. That's a big order.
We're seeing in lots of places a great deal of public interest in doing that, and we're getting approached all the time by members of state legislatures, city councils, so forth, who want to act. They want to know what they can do. I think there's the situation has really changed quite a bit in the last couple of years with this rash of hurricanes and floods and wildfires. It is really highlighted to many, many people around the country as well as around the world the urgency of the situation.
We heard President Trump say, no planes, no energy. When the wind stops blowing, that's the end of your electric and so on. There have been raised a lot of concerns about wind and solar. There's an argument over nuclear power and whether that's going to have to be involved. And, of course, nuclear power is a very controversial matter just in and of itself. So are you being idealistic rather than realistic?
No, I think we're being very realistic because the book relies entirely on proven technologies that are in use in various parts of the world. The place in the United States that has the most wind power, that generates the most electricity from wind, is Texas. Number two is Iowa. And that's obviously not because of any ideological orientation. It's because they have found that it works economically and they have very reliable electricity supplies. The methods of electricity storage and transmission so that when the wind doesn't blow, you still have electricity are very far advanced. And so I think that what we are talking about is ambitious, but it is entirely achievable. And the cost of not doing it is immensely worse. If we don't do this, if we don't rapidly move away from fossil fuels and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the consequences for the economy are much more severe than anything that it'll cost to implement this plan.
So explain then to anybody who is listening who wants to do something how to get the book, how to use it, given whatever situation they might be in.
So the book was published by the Environmental Law Institute in Washington, D.C. So if you just Google Environmental Law Institute, you'll find out how to get the book, and it will show you the recommendations. You can also download for free a brief summary, a 160-page summary of the book that has the key recommendations, and go through there and contact your local elected officials try to get them to implement this. And if you are a lawyer and you want to volunteer to help out, let me know, and we'll see what we can do.
So you want to start a revolution?
We want to have a lawful, peaceful energy revolution.
Michael Girard, director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change at Columbia University. Once again, very importantly, the book is Legal Pathways to Deep Decarbonization in the United States. Thanks a lot and good luck.
Thank you.
This has been a climate change update on To the Point, produced by Andrea Brody with audio assistance from Chris Wotherspoon. Chuck Previtary is our engineer. I'm Warren Almy. Also this week, it takes fiction to tell the truth about Washington, with reporter-turned-novelist Tom Rosenstiel. Join us wherever you get your podcasts and give us a shout on Twitter at tothepoint_KCRW. I'm at warren.almy@kcrw.org.